This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. You know, as Michael Moore proclaimed, America is not broke, not even close.
Overall, individual wealth in the United States has risen 23% since the year 2000 to $236,213 per American adult. But wealth has become incredibly more concentrated.
We are taxing the dollars that go to our ever richer rich at levels far below the tax rates that American levied just a few decades ago.
Now, both an analysis of our current predicament and a series of proposals that can help open our eyes to a far more equitable and brighter future with May June Louis, Director of Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative, the Insight Center for Community Economic Development,
and Chuck Collins, who is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, and directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He is co-author of the recent report, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Government Shutdown. And I feel particularly good because it's kind of a reunion to bring Chuck and Maejun together again.
Great to be on with you, Chuck.
Yeah.
Sure, she's a little bit spoiled because she's going to be speaking to us or is speaking to us from Hawaii, but we're also going to take advantage of that and find out a little bit more about what is going on in Hawaii, which is something that we very rarely hear about. But let's begin with, so America isn't broke, but there's a broadening wealth disparity. Is that really what's going on? So in other words, instead of democratizing and redistributing or equalizing, there's a growing wealth disparity. Are we really talking about the robber barons of old? Maejun?
Well, let Chuck start with that to talk about the growing wealth gap in general, and I will then talk about the growing racial wealth gap.
You know, I talked to this friend of mine who runs a food bank outside Chicago. Seen the number of people coming into her food bank who are hungry double in the last 4 months and had her budget cut. And she said, you know, this whole thing that we're broke, we're such a wealthy country. There's so much wealth. It's just sort of in the hands of a few. And I love this thing she said to me. She said, you know, we're not broke. We're just twisted. There's something twisted about our politics and our morality and the distribution of wealth. And, you know, in the last generation, the concentration of wealth has grown. So today, 1% of the population has about 35, almost 36% of all the private wealth, which is about $20 trillion in the hands of 100,000 households. So that's a huge concentration of wealth. And the tax policies, both towards corporations, there's dozens of companies that pay zero taxes, profitable companies. In the last generation, their taxes have gone down, and taxes on millionaires have gone down. So when, you know, Michael Moore and others people say, hey, we're not broke, they're absolutely right. If we use the same tax rules we had a generation ago, we wouldn't be in the situation where we were having to cut budgets and lay off teachers and close community colleges and all this other nonsense. It's just completely unnecessary.
You know, Chuck has talked about the growing wealth disparity in our country in general, which has really reached just outrageous proportions. But then if you take a closer look and you just aggregate by race, we have another very disturbing story, because the mainstream idea is that progress is slow, but it is happening and it's gradual, so that if we look at the time since the civil rights movement, we would expect to see a narrowing gap in whites and people of color when it comes to the economy. However, in a report that was done last year, it was found that over the last generation, between 1984 and 2007, the wealth gap between blacks and whites actually quadrupled. So that is just an enormous growth right there. And in fact, when we started doing this work, actually Chuck and I started doing this work some time ago, but even in 2004, the gap between blacks and whites, for example, was 100 to 12, so that a black family at the median owned about 12 cents to the dollar owned by a white family at the median. But by 2007, 3 years later, and this was before the official recession was called, that had dropped to 10 cents to the dollar. You know, if we keep going at this rate, we will see it drop to nothing. And this is really a problem because we know, too, that while income is very important in terms of survival, it really is assets that help you get ahead. And as we think about workers and what their situation is, ownership of assets, which allows you to be most economically mobile and economically secure, is farther and farther out of reach of many Americans of all races, but particularly those of color.
And I guess the question would be right now, why has this been happening? Is it tax policy? Is it totally that? Is it because of the decline of unions? Is it because of something else? Why is this concentration of wealth, both in terms of the total population and also in terms of African Americans and other groups, why has this been happening in the last 20, 30 years?
Many things have to do with it, but let me just say one thing about tax policy, and Chuck, you can add in as well. So, for example, the cut in the capital gains tax, that we certainly know that there is a concentration of people who own stocks and other kinds of investments in the top percentages of our population. But in terms of the racial gap, when that happened, people of color are a quarter less likely than all families to own publicly traded stock. So, therefore, that particular tax cut exacerbated the racial gap as well as exacerbating the gap in general. And Chuck, who is probably the nation's expert on the estate tax, and he'll probably talk more about that. But again, when it comes to inheritance, while one in four white Americans receive an inheritance, only one in 20 African Americans do. And when they do, they receive only 8 cents compared to the white inheritor's dollar. So once again, big windfall, not just to the richest Americans, but those do tend to be white Americans.
You know, why has it happened? In a way, there has been a shift in power. I think the decline of organized labor, the clout of labor to kind of enforce a social contract between workers and industries has meant that the rules of the economy have more and more drifted to sort of be tilted in favor of wealth holders at the expense of wage earners. And so there's a lot of different reasons why inequality is growing, but at the heart of it, I think it's because corporations have sort of, and the wealthy have captured our democratic system and then passed laws and rules like tax policy, but also trade policy and wage laws and that have essentially worked in favor of those who already have substantial wealth. I think Meiji's point is important because sometimes we think, oh, these policies are race blind or something like that. But as she points out, if you put a focus on cutting capital gains or reducing the inheritance tax, that's a huge benefit to the top 1% and to white households are the huge beneficiaries of those.
Let me just point out one other thing, too, which is the huge increase in college costs and medical costs, so that both of those kinds of costs have been growing much, much faster than inflation. So if you take college, for example, that is supposed to be the way up and out of poverty and into the middle class. But it's becoming less and less affordable, and college debt is immense. And again, there is a disproportionate burden on youth of color whose parents may not have as much to set aside for their college education, not to mention the fact that they sometimes live in communities where, since we rely on the property tax for our public education, they're just not getting ahead as much as whites. But I think in both of those cases, we have to think both about how do we get more college tuition, how do we make that more affordable, how do we make medical care more affordable, and I do think that the Obama health bill has taken some steps in that direction, but in both cases, we really have to think about the cost side as well, and how do we bring down the cost at that end.
Meiji, you did a report recently about the issue of wealth disparity and its impact on children. Talk about that, because that's the way in which the report develops that issue is a little different than some of us normally think about it, and very, very important.
We took a look at the wealth of households with young children, and we found that there was a big gap between households that have adequate income as well as some assets, so that 50% of white households had incomes of over 185% of poverty and had multiple assets, which means that they had savings accounts, perhaps college accounts, retirement accounts, other kinds of investments, maybe some business assets as well. But only 14% of blacks and Latinos had similar advantages. And then we took a look at correlating wealth with cognitive outcomes for young children and found that at 9 months of age, almost all children do pretty much equally well, children of all races, on standardized tests, cognitive tests. But by 2 years, you can see a widening gap between the cognitive scores of the children from families that have better economic security than those who do not have that. And since we see the racial gap, unfortunately, it is children of color that are falling behind, starting at 2 years of age. So I think the thing that is so both shocking about this is that you know that that disadvantage will follow them throughout their life, throughout their school years, graduation, their ability to get into college, and so on. And I think that our takeaway from this, too, was that these are the children that will become middle-aged by the time our country becomes majority-minority, so that at that point we will have a bunch of people who are really going to shoulder the burden of the American economy, and they're not going to be well prepared for it. So we really recommended that our government, that the people of the country, take a look now and think about how can we build assets for all poor people, but especially for those of color who have so few, in order to get them ready to be the ones who are the bearing the all of the burdens of the middle of the 21st century.
Now, we've been talking about basically secular trends, things over a number of years, but right now we're in an economic crisis and there's major cutbacks in services both on the state and projected on the federal level also, in addition to, of course, the direct effects of the recession, and it is a recession in terms of unemployment. So how has this situation been exacerbated in the last 2-3 years?
Well, I guess I would just say the economic meltdown obviously is living on in the lives of many, many people, both in terms of unemployment and underemployment and just a sense of insecurity, people losing their homes. And then on top of that, because state and the federal government revenue has gone down as a result of the economic meltdown. So you have every governor in every state saying we're broke, and you know, conservatives and the Republican majority in the House saying we're broke, we have these huge deficits, we have to make these extreme cuts. And you know, on the one hand, you have, if they go through with these cuts, that's actually going to probably worsen the economic crisis. And the causes of the loss in revenue aren't because public employees are getting paid decent wages. It has to do with a revenue problem. And we've been cutting taxes for corporations and cutting taxes for the wealthy for the last two decades. We don't have to have this kind of phony austerity where we have to roll up our sleeves and everybody has to experience the pain except the millionaires. That's completely unnecessary. We just tax corporations that earned $1 million or more, or households, you know, individual millionaire families, at the same rate we did in 1961, that would generate about $716 billion a year, or $7 trillion over the next decade. So there's an example of there's plenty of money in the system. If we simply taxed millionaires, taxed some of these global companies, made them pay their fair share, we wouldn't be in this kind of, you know, this sort of dire straits story that we're in. So we are in an economic crisis. If we kind of worsen the situation by laying off public employees, cutting jobs, cutting federal funds, that will only worsen a precarious economic crisis that we're already in.
Yeah, right. And I think that the recession showed that government was important not only as a funder, as we often think of it, but also as a regulator. So the failure to regulate the mortgage markets was really at the heart of the whole crisis. And with that failure to regulate and the failure to enforce non-discrimination laws, people of color, even with high incomes who were really qualified for a prime mortgage rate, were steered to subprime loans, and so that the foreclosure rate in communities of color is 3 times that of whites. And then it has sort of a domino effect in those neighborhoods. So even though you're doing fine and you can pay your mortgage, if 3 houses on your street are in foreclosure, that's going to make you lose as well. So it really is a dire situation, and I think that the passage of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was a huge victory, but now, of course, already before it's even set up, they're trying to water it down. So I think we have to be very careful to make sure that the regulatory side is still in place. But I think, too, it was quite disappointing with President Obama, who noted in his State of the Union speech that domestic spending for programs that really just help poorer families survive, it's a small percent of the budget, but then he went ahead and cut them anyway. When any sensible family that loses a job or loses income understands that, you know, you can save yourself in two ways. You can increase income by taking a part-time job or sending more people to work or whatever, as well as by cutting your costs. But our government doesn't seem to be understanding that and is not really looking hard enough at where they can find new revenues or to shift revenues from those who it hurts less, you know, from those who it hurts less to make sure that we can serve those who are hurt more.
Chuck, you have you mentioned one or two of the ways to redistribute income, and you have a number of more in your report, Institute for Policy Studies, I believe it was, that would also redistribute income. But there's another point also which I just want to make, that if you redistribute income from the rich to the poor are more likely to spend it and more likely to create demand, which will get us out of the recession to begin with. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that is the economic wisdom. Tax cuts for the wealthy don't necessarily actually have a positive stimulus effect on the economy because wealthy people, they save more. They don't have an urgent demand to spend money, and they could move that money anywhere on the planet, including into speculative investments. If you give a tax cut or a direct tax break to a lower-income family, middle-income family, tends to get spent and tends to have a more stimulating effect in a local economy where, you know, where people live. That's a really important consideration. And if I were to make the policy suggestions, I would say, well, look, we could reverse some of the tax cuts we've given millionaires for the last several decades. That adding brackets for very high income, you know, sort of taxing at higher rates incomes over $1 million, that would raise substantial revenue. We could get specific if you'd like, but there's a bunch of revenue proposals that, you know, when people say to me, oh, we just don't have any money, we're broke, I could say, well, here, let me give you $4 trillion over 10 years for starters just by closing tax loopholes on corporations and getting millionaires to pay their fair share. There's a lot of potential there.
Just to follow on that really quickly, there's a popular misconception that is, I think, fostered by the mainstream press sometimes that when you allow wealthy people to keep more of their money, they will invest in ways that create more jobs and make more productive capacity in the United States. That is really not true, because when you buy stocks, you are not necessarily investing in greater capacity. You're simply gambling that particular company will do better, and you're buying it from another person who held the stock before. So there's no new capacity that is built by that. So as Chuck points out, though, if a lower-income person spends that money at the grocery store or at the local, whatever, boutique, it circulates in the local economy, and it creates even more wealth rather than simply being a gamble. So, yeah, I think that there's some public education that needs to take place in terms of what really happens to those dollars.
Yeah, same thing when people talk about General Electric. You know, oh, if we force General Electric to pay their taxes, that's going to cut jobs. These are a lot of the same companies that are kind of absorbing huge amounts of tax subsidies and not paying taxes at all are also offshoring and outsourcing at intense rates. They're, you know, we the taxpayers gave General Electric $3 billion in tax breaks last year. Of course you create jobs.
If you look at a company like Walmart, which in some places is paying its employees so little that the rest of the taxpayers are subsidizing their health care because they qualify for Medicaid. I mean, this is ridiculous. And then you look at all of the Walton children, each one of whom has about $18 billion in wealth. Is that a smart way to spend our money?
Yeah.
I'm disappointed, though, that you didn't include the financial transactions tax in your list.
Yeah, actually, I would put it on my top three list is a simple financial transaction tax, which, you know, a penny on every $4 of currency exchanges, stock market investments, derivatives, hedge fund investments, you put a small tax on that, would generate $150 billion a year. Close the overseas tax havens, kind of basically close up those ability of corporations to take their earnings and pretend that their profits are being earned in the Cayman Islands. close that up, you've got another $100 billion a year.
Right, and in terms of that financial transaction tax, it also might calm a little bit what Greenspan called the irrational exuberance of the market. If it costs you nothing to make these purchases every fraction of a second, you will do it, which really was part of the problem. I just wanted to mention, too, that you probably know about, but John Conyers from Michigan has proposed that there be a financial tax and that it be used to fund an employment program that would kick in when unemployment reached 7%. It would automatically trigger a federal jobs program and that would be paid for by a fund created by this financial transaction tax.
Now, this is pretty much the same way as the Progressive Caucus of the, I guess it would be the House, their proposals. There may be one or two things in that wasn't, but this is pretty much something that's in consideration right now, right?
Yeah, I think the progressives are coming. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Major.
No, go ahead, Chuck.
I was going to say, I think the progressives are coming up with a growing similar list, whether in the House or in the Senate. So Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, who's a leader in the Progressive Caucus, has said, let's just add a few more top tax rates for millionaires. But, yeah, there's a growing consensus, I guess, that there's five or six ways to raise substantial revenue in the next couple of years that progressives can line up behind. And actually, is the Bush tax cuts. Those tax cuts to millionaires and the cuts in the estate tax have cost, almost over a trillion dollars. People keep complaining about the deficit. Well, we gave the super rich in this country $1 trillion over the last 10 years.
And we're going to give the last 35 seconds to Mei-Jun Louie.
More and more people are not working, so we have a proposal that's even more bigger than the others, which is to have a permanent guaranteed job program funded by the government so that every American who wanted to work would have a job and have some other components in terms of education and training, particularly for youth. We didn't see any other way to close the unemployment gap, especially for youth of color, when more than half of them cannot find a job. We would save money on the other end by not having to pay for the remedial types of activities that we have when young people who are looking to become financially independent can't find a job. So I think this is a time when we should be putting out big and bold ideas that may not seem practicable at this moment, but we need to put our stake in the ground and really think about what do we need, what kind of an economy, what kind of a society do we want in the future.
Well, they seem very practical to me. So where can people find out more about them so we can get behind these things and build that kind of collective agenda that will serve us well and going forward really propagate the interests of the working class? Mei-Jun, where do we find out more?
Well, you can go to racialwealthgap.org and take a look there. And we do have a Facebook site and we tweet as well, or at least some of my younger colleagues do.
And Chuck Collins.
I would encourage people to look at U.S. Uncut, which is kind of this grassroots movement that's looking at how to stop budget cuts by closing corporate tax dodgers. And then if people want to learn more about these inequality issues, we have a new website going up this week called inequality.org, and you can see our new portal for inequality information, and the study Unnecessary Austerity is there, along with other stuff.
You've given us a lot to think about and real concrete issues and responses to work on. America isn't broke. The question is how the wealth gets distributed and from whom we seek to raise it.
In other words, tax the rich already.
Enough already. That's Ken's mantra.
Yeah.
Mei-Jun Louie, we'll have to have you back. And Mei-Jun is the director of Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative, the Insight Center for Community Economic Development, and Chuck Collins, Senior Scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, and he directs the IPS's program on inequality and the common good, and you work beautifully in tandem there. And go to that website so we can put some meat on the bones of an agenda to advocate for. It's been a pleasure. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.